The Texas Hill Country is a rising star in America's wine industry. Destinations such as Fredericksburg, Texas have morphed in recent years from bucolic historical small-town experiences into trendy wine destinations. The same thing is happening in Burnett County's Highland Lakes region. Come along for a visit at two of the area's up-and-coming wineries. We'll start our adventure at Tornalox Vineyard and Winery. It's the new kid on the block. Their vines are just 2 years old now and not yet producing. So in the meantime, the owners, Karen DeBerry and her husband, source the best of the best grapes from around the region. She talks soils and targeted varietals that they are counting on to produce big, bold, tasty Texas wines. Afterwards, we'll stop in for a conversation at Parisos Vineyard and Winery about trend-setting soil practices that have reduced crop loss from 15% down to 2%. Winemaker and owner Seth Martin at Parisos Vineyard and Winery also shares his hard-earned knowledge of the varietals that are ideally suited for the soil and temperature characteristics of the region to craft the best of the best in the Texas Hill Country. And he's proven his skills with an array of awards, including a double gold at the prestigious San Francisco Chronicle Wine Competition. I'm correspondent Tom Wilmer. Come along and join our exploration of Texas wines with two of their passionate wine growers and winemakers.
'Cause I'm from Texas too.
I'm Karen, and you're here with me at Tornalox Winery in Burnett, Texas.
You got a Gaelic name there. How did that happen?
We bought this property when we were living in Aberdeen, Scotland, so we gave it a Gaelic name. Means hill over lakes, because we're on a hill overlooking both Inks and Buchanan Lakes.
This is a new winery in Texas, isn't it?
That's right. We opened our tasting room in mid-September, so we're about, I guess, six and a half months down the road.
And your plants are, what, second anniversary a little while ago?
That's right. We put the vines in the ground just about almost exactly 2 years ago.
And what did you plant and what are you hoping to plant?
We currently have planted Syrah, Malbec, and Petite Syrah. And in the future, we'd like to get a couple of white varietals, probably Vermentino or Albarino, perhaps, as well as more Petite Syrah, because we really like that one.
And for the listener, whereabouts are you located?
We are on State Highway 29 West, just 6.5 miles west of Burnett, Texas.
How many wineries are there in the county, in the region? Just roughly.
There's hundreds in the state, and in this, I would say within a half-hour drive from where we are, you could probably at least 15, and there's new ones popping up every day.
Mm-hmm. For you two, why did you make that decision to open a winery and become winemakers?
Well, that's a good one. We were touring wineries in Western Australia, and we were inspired by Cape Grace Winery that we had stopped into. Their property is similar to ours as far as just the red dirt, the scrubby brush, and we got to talking to the owners, and they talked about how they were living the dream, and we thought, hey, that sounds pretty good. Maybe we'll try that.
So you obviously had an interest and you liked wine, are you right?
We did. We weren't big wine drinkers all of our lives, but when we moved to Singapore in 2001, the house that we were renting had a huge wine fridge in the basement that was empty when we arrived. It got full and empty many times while we were living in the house, so that's kind of got us into the whole wine thing.
Wow. So when you're in Singapore, they weren't all Taiwanese wines, right?
No, they were mostly from Australia and New Zealand. That was what was easy. Easy to get in that area.
Readily available on market. You know.
Yeah.
Have you noticed any parallels here with the Texas wines in Western Australia?
Really not so much. I mean, we have some of the same varietals that they grow there, but, you know, compared to the rest of the world, the Texas wine industry is still somewhat in its first generation, maybe entering the second. So we're so much younger than everybody else still. We're making great strides, and I think it's becoming pretty generally well known out there that the quality of Texas wine has greatly improved over the last several years.
Neither of you were majors in viticulture. So this is something that is second vocation, something you guys been having to learn. What's the process been of learning for you?
As far as the viticulture aspect of it, I actually did a certificate program through Texas Tech University in conjunction with the Texas Agricultural Extension Service. And that's where I picked up a lot of the viticulture. But like anything, you know, until you're in the midst of it with your hands in the dirt, you can read all the books that you want. But until you're actually doing it, it doesn't really click and make a lot of sense. And then as far as the winemaking side, my husband and I have no formal training whatsoever, but we do have a very good friend who's been consulting with us, who's a very experienced winemaker. And so that's been very helpful.
Is it rewarding overall or frustrating for you, the process of actually making the wine in once it's picked?
Yes, it's rewarding and frustrating all at the same time. But overall, yes, it's rewarding to see quite literally the fruits of our labor.
And so the world of barrels has probably become fascinating for you. New oak, neutral oak, French oak.
That's right. That's been a big learning experience. And like I said, we've gotten some good advice from some longtime winemakers. And we have, I think, a pretty good mix of oak on this first batch of estate wines that we have aging currently. We've got a good mix of new oak as well as fully depleted. So I think it's going to be just about the right mix when it's all said and done.
And how about the modern incarnations? For example, some people are moving to screw tops for some of their whites. Is this something that you would do?
We actually do use screw. Yes, all of our whites, our rosé, have screw caps. We have one red blend that we use a screw cap on because it's a wine that's meant to be sort of a table wine.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's not gonna be put it away for 10 years.
Yeah. Exactly. You're gonna drink it while it's young. So we decided to go screw cap with that one. But for our other reds that people might be more likely to cellar for a while, we're using natural cork for those.
And synthetic cork really hasn't caught on, has it?
You know, you see it, but I'm just not a fan for a lot of reasons, so we chose to go with the natural.
Yeah. Well, I mess with what has worked for a few centuries,
right. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. Well, anything that you'd like to add about, anything you would like to add before we go?
Oh, okay.
Dreams and visions, hopes and aspirations?
Well, I definitely would like to expand the vineyard. We only have 3 acres under vine currently, and I'd like to get that up to about 10. And then obviously we're just looking forward to the word continuing to get out that we're here, and look forward to more and more people coming to visit us.
Well, thanks so much, Karen. This is great.
Thank you. I appreciate it very much.
We're at Parasols Vineyard and Winery with the owner, Seth Barton.
Good to see you.
Yeah, it's great to come here. What a surprise. You beat my expectations big time. Not only in the literal taste of your wine, very impressed with, but your vineyard practices. Share with us some of the things that you're doing that are a little bit apart from what mainstream is.
Sure. Appreciate the compliments on the wine. The chief attribute of our location is the soil. Our little pocket, as we talked about in the vineyard tour, is we're in a little pocket of decomposed granite gravel. Geologically, it's called the granite gravel aquifer. And it's a little pocket that's about 3 miles by about 13 miles. The attributes in the soil that make it perfect for grapevines is it's basically pH neutral, slightly acidic, really well drained, has just enough clay for water holding capacity, and it's essentially devoid of organic matter. And so for about the last 5 or 6 years, we've been engaged in a practice called biological agriculture, which is we don't use any synthetic chemicals or fertilizers to nourish the plants. So we every year use about 210,000 to 250,000 pounds of compost over 12 miles. That's 16 acres of grapevines. And then we lightly till that in. And the compost comes from a company called New Earth, which is the same people who make the ladybug products. Then when we feed the vines in April and early June or late May, through the irrigation system, we'll feed on a per acre basis about 2 gallons of molasses, 2 gallons of fish, 2 gallons of seaweed and kelp per acre.
Through a drip system?
It's called a fertigation system. It's fertilization and irrigation simultaneously. And then what that does is it gets about the same amount per vine, so we have to calibrate the system and make sure it's working properly, of course, before we turn it on. And what those foods are is they're foods for the microbes that come in with the compost, which are the beneficial microbes, which are bacteria, fungus, protozoa and nematodes and those kind of things. And they eat those food inputs of the seaweed, the kelp, and molasses, and the fish, And the byproducts from their excretions are immediately available plant nutrients. And then when they die, they are immediately available plant nitrogen. So it's kind of a different way of thinking about farming and agriculture. Unfortunately, it's also the most expensive way because it requires special equipment. The compost is expensive. You know, just buying 250-gallon drums of fish hydrolysate was, you know, $2,500. And
obviously, you believe in a payback down the road, or you wouldn't have made that investment.
Yeah, I think for me, the reason we got into this is about 10 years ago, we were losing about 10 to 15% of our vines a year to cotton root rot and some other soil-borne pathogens. And so I didn't want to resort to using chemical soil sterilization practices, which require a lot of chemicals. It seems kind of dangerous to me to do that. So that's why I started researching this other methodology, again, called biological agriculture. And the lady who's the chief proponent of that is, her name is Elaine Ingham, I-N-G-H-A-M. And
where is she based, do you know?
You know, I don't know. I think it's called the Soil Food Web is her website. A huge amount of material in there. And she has programs that she teaches on, you know, compost tea applications and all this kind of stuff that we're discussing. Over the last 6-7 years, I'll tell you that my rate of vine decline has gone down from, you know, say 10-12% down to in the 2% range. Mm-hmm. The vines are healthier. Fruit is tastier. And I'll tell you that of the ones that we've tried today, the Alianico, I think, was the first ever Texas wine to win a best of class at the San Francisco Chronicle Wine Competition. Our Viognier that we tried today won a double gold at the same competition. So we've gotten a lot of big awards at international competitions. And I've got to think that in response to a truly healthy plant, from a soil point of view, you're going to get the healthiest, tastiest fruit that's going to convert into the best wine. So your input of raw materials is based on, in large part, the health of your plant.
On another level, one of the huge variables in your world is the old farmer's world of weather, of temperature, and those are pretty extremes in your world, aren't they?
Yeah, it's farming. You can't, you know, we don't get the luxury of having a manufacturing facility and controlling all the variables and the inputs. We get nervous when we look at weather reports and see pockets of hail or cold temperatures, you know, late in the spring. You know, so there's a lot of variables and, you know, rainfall at the wrong time of the year can create fungus rot, delay the ripening or dilute the fruit if it's really close to harvest. So yeah, our input of raw materials is different every single year, which is why to me winemaking is more art than it is science. We're growing the wine in the field.
In real specific environmental conditions that you deal with that somebody coastal environment, California, for example, would rarely ever deal with, and that's hot days along with hot nights.
That's true. So a lot of the varietals, and that does that combination of variables, so we're at about 880 feet of elevation at this vineyard, and if and when it gets to be over 100 degrees, which is very common in July, August, September, because of our lack of high altitude, we don't get the benefit of cool evenings. And so that has a lot of implications for a vineyard, but the chief implication is that not every varietal is going to grow well here. And I've been growing like Cabernet Sauvignon, which is, I'm not sure if it's the most widely planted varietal in the world, but I know it probably is the biggest in California. I don't think we could ever match what they could do with a cheap California Cabernet with the greatest of our efforts here, because we're about 50% hotter, we don't have cool evenings, and it's just not the right climate. Now, on the other hand, Italian varietals like Montepulciano, Alianico, Dolcetto, Spanish varietals like Tempranillo, Trigo Nacional that need the heat, they don't seem to be too bothered by the lack of cool evenings, those seem to thrive here. And so we could likely do a better job with those than they could do in California. Not that California is the comparison benchmark, but they have, I think I've seen reports ranging from, they have clearly over 1 million acres of producing wine grapes. And I think I've seen varying surveys in Texas, and I think I've seen numbers range from 5,000 to 7,000 acres of producing vines. So we clearly have a long way to go in figuring out which varietals are going to be the kingpin varietals for Texas.
Today, in your world, is there a flagship? Is there a wine that is your flagship?
So I'm the grape grower and the winemaker. You know, everybody talks about wine is made in the field, and that's true. So if that's the definition of the perfect grape, then you would have to find a grape that would retain its acidity in spite of the heat, and so that when you bring it into the winery, you're not having to play organic chemist and manipulate the wines overly with acid and things like that. And so the answer to that question for me would be Aglianico, which is a southern Italian red grape varietal. And our Aglianico, not to be boastful, but in two out of the last 3 years at the San Francisco Chronicle, it got best of class, which is two out of 3 years grown right in rows 27 through 54. We have 3 acres of it. And so it's the very last one to come off the vine. Another very promising varietal that satisfies that same definition for us is Montepulciano, which is another southern Italian red grape. It also has required little to no manipulation in the winery. And so there's other varietals that do well. The Tempranillo does really well. Viognier does very well. Syrah does very well. Petite Syrah does exceedingly well. Malbec does really well. But all the other varietals do require considerable more work in the winery. Now, that's not to say they're not award-winning great wines. They just require more work.
It's interesting. So you can get into southern France and still have one that works here.
Yeah, we can. I would say that in terms of reds, the only one that would be southern French would be Syrah.
Well, Malbec.
I guess Malbec originated there, but everybody considers that Malbec is now Argentinian. It's a national grape of Argentina. And our clone is Clone 9, which hailed from Argentina. Yes, it started in France, but it's like Syrah. Syrah is from France, but Shiraz is from Australia. Same clones, and Zinfandel is Zinfandel in California, but Primitivo in Italy. So there's a lot of genetically identical plants that they claim have evolved over time to be more heat tolerant.
Seth, I wish we could go on, but I know you've got to pick some kids up. So you know what that means. I just have to come back for a Reed Prize visit at your winery. What a treat, what a pleasure. And before we go, website for their information.
Yeah, it's parasosvineyards.com. And from there, you can join our mailing list. And I'm not even sure if our selection of wines is updated, but we'll have to work on that. And we're open Friday, Saturday, Sundays for tastings from noon to 5. At any given time, we're tasting out about 75 to 80% of estate-grown wines. And we've never had anything on our real estate unless it was physically grown in the state of Texas.
Seth Martin, thanks again.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas Award-winning travel show, Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a weekly featured podcast on NPR.org, produced by California Central Coast NPR affiliate KCBX. Our San Francisco-based associate producer is Molly Blaisdell, covering the San Francisco Bay Area, the island of Maui, and the South Pacific. Our Wisconsin-based associate producer is Julie Henning.